Thankfully, I don't have to attend all of those.
Meeting is called order.
I don't remember her name.
Now, do you want to do a green piece?
Thank you.
Just when you get to the.
Oh, okay.
I'll take the frame.
Okay, gotcha. Roll call.
Gordon Ford.
I'm here.
Maria DeAndis.
Here.
Donna Riley.
Here.
Jason Gordo.
Here.
Mike Lynch.
Here.
Jim DeMartini.
Here.
Jeff Grover. Darren Garrett. Michael O'Neill.
Here.
Joan Clendenon.
Here.
We have a form.
Actually, I forgot to read the. What? Actually, I forgot to read the public statement. Do we have any members of the public here? Okay. Then I will.
Got away with that one.
I know. You know, I got to get into a routine here. Okay, announcements.
I do have an announcement. We have received the signed minutes for January 14th. So those have been signed by council and will be swapped out from the packet, from the ones in the packet you received today that aren't signed. And also we received a market update after your packet went out that will go along with 6C, and that's been handed out to you along with that item. Those are the only two announcements I have.
Okay. Public comment. Okay. Consent items, number five. We have a motion. Do we want to take anything out of order?
Move to.
We have a motion.
Do you have a session? You have to phone me out?
No.
Do we have a second? We have a motion.
Second.
What was the motion?
To approve consent.
To approve consent. Okay, we have a motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, so moved. Number six, SIS.
Let me say one thing before you go here. 6A, discussion and action regarding asset allocation and capital market expectation review. There was a mistake on this. This item is not a discussion and action item. It's just an informational item itself.
Great. Let me introduce John formally. You guys got a chance to meet him already a couple times, but he is, as he leads this discussion, is the head of our quantitative efforts at SIS. And so fortunate to have him on the team and certainly able to field questions and discussions as this document hopefully provokes that. So I'll turn it over to him.
Thank you. So quantitative and kind of in consulting terms means you do the asset liability, asset allocation stuff. So
do you want the overhead on?
I don't need it. If
everybody has
want,
it.
If everybody, if you want to look at it, it's fine. Okay. But it's a short presentation. Yes, it says asset allocation update. It's really, the meat of it is two pages. First page just says, this is what we're going to talk about. The third page is, talks about here the expectations, and this is really what we're here for, to say every 6 months SIS goes through a process of looking at the markets and developing long-term expectations about the markets, and that expectations are in terms of long-term return expectations, long-term risk expectations, and the correlations of the asset classes with one another. We did this the last time we did this. We do it in May and in November. And you may actually think, well, why is that particular time frame when you do that? There's a publication that we've always used that the basis of our economic, I'll call it our economic forecast. So things like GDP, CPI, interest rate forecasts, things like that. There's a publication called Blue Chip Economic Forecast, and it's a survey of 50 leading economists. So we're not economists ourselves, so we use this document as our basis for our economic forecasts. And it comes out, it comes out monthly, but every 6 months, they ask the economists to give them a long-term forecast. So that every 6 months, they come up with a 10-year forecast. We use that as the basis for economic forecasts and then incorporate that into our expectations. Comes out in April and in October. So our expectations are updated shortly after that. As you can see on the page, you know, we have the returns that you presented a year ago and what they are right now. Generally, what you'll see is that expectations have come down.
John, so you're on page two, page two, the third page of the presentation.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, it's a summary of updated capital market projections. So we have on the left is the asset classes, what the expectations were November 2013, and what our current expectations are for those same asset classes as of November 2014. Now, like I said, what you'll see is that generally all the expectations have been dropping. And that's part of it is that's what the markets are doing in terms of fixed, you know, interest rates and fixed income expectations. Interest rates have been continually dropping, and they have dropped from a year ago. So kind of as a going forward, as rates come down, that's a really good forecast of the return you're going to get for the next few years. So we go out and we use what level of interest rates are there to help us generate our return forecast for all our fixed income asset classes. So as interest rates have come down, so have our expectations for fixed income. Equities, it's a little different. In we're looking again at GDP growth and current valuations to come up with an expectation for equities. We also look at equities in terms of what has happened more recently. So as returns for an asset class have been good, we believe that going forward, the returns are going to be less. So if you look at our expectations, they've kind of ebbed and flowed based on what the markets. So if we've got these expectations going back to the mid-90s, and you can look at our equity expectations at the peak of the bubble, and they were low. After the bubble burst, our expectations went up. Same thing relative to the financial crisis. Right before the financial crisis, our expectations were pretty low. After the financial crisis, our expectations actually were higher, which, you know, kind of pat ourselves on the back. That turned out to be a pretty good call. Now, one of the things that came out of the financial crisis was people looking back at that point in time and saying, "Oh, the 10-year return for equities was low after you got through the financial crisis. So going forward, oh, we should lower our expectations." And we did just the opposite. Kind of at that point in time, we were raising our expectations. And so now, 5 years hence, we are basically at the same position other people were 5 years ago, saying returns from this point forward aren't particularly spectacular. And so even though these are long-term forecasts, we have continued to reduce our equity expectations because of you've gotten a lot of return from the markets. Another thing that's happened over this period is it's not only the absolute numbers, but the inflation that is embedded in our expectations. Inflation expectations for the last few years have continued to fall, not by big numbers, but they've continued to drop a little bit. So a few years ago, our inflation expectations were maybe 2.5, and now they're down to 2.1%. Again, this is a mix of this inflation forecast, which is an underlying tenet to our expectations, has fallen, and therefore our nominal returns have fallen, but kind of the returns after inflation have fallen as well, but not as much. Okay? And in a pension fund, it's that real number, kind of the difference between what you think for inflation is what you're going to get for inflation and what payroll growth will be. The difference between that and your nominal return is what's really important. Okay? I didn't explain that very well. So our expectations have fallen because of inflation. Okay? Because your liabilities essentially grow as you pay, because your benefits are indexed to inflation. Or pay growth. As pay growth, if inflation is higher, pay growth is going to be higher, your liabilities are going to be higher. Kind of it's the same, kind of that characteristic. So if inflation is lower, we expect, pay growth will be lower, your liabilities will be lower. So it's really what matters is the real return, the nominal, the return minus inflation versus the nominal. So if we go as an example, let's go back to the 70s. Okay. Returns in the 70s, if you looked at a mix, was somewhere in the 7 or 8%. You look at it on a nominal basis, that's a really good return. Gets you about your current actual rate of interest. However, pay growth was in the 8 to 9% or more. So even though your nominal return was pretty good, your real return was negative, and actually on an asset liability context, you got completely torched. Okay? So you can't just look at the nominal returns, you got to really look at the real return, because it only tells you part of the story. Okay? So like I said, the returns are on page 2. We then took those returns and we applied them to a number of mixes. We looked at your current mix and said, okay, what was, if we apply those returns to what the mix was as of the end of December, we looked at the current policy mix, your current target. So you adopted a new target a couple of years ago. Okay, when you did the asset liability study, adopted a new target, but there were some parts of that portfolio that you couldn't get to quickly. So there's this, what I call current policies, kind of a in between where you are and where you're going to be. And then there's I put an expected policy mix of saying, okay, if you're still making progress towards this target, what might it be for the next couple of years? It's more of my expectation versus whether or not you're really going to get there. So you can see what the mixes are. And then the nominal returns at the bottom, ranging from 6.3, all around the 6.5 to 6.5 to 6.6 return. Standard deviations around 12%, generally consistent with what they were a year ago. These returns are slightly lower than they were a year ago, but not huge, just a little bit lower. And the risks are slightly higher because we think the markets are a little riskier now than they were a year ago. Then at the bottom of the page, we also talk about inflation, which I was talking about, is 2.1%. The real return, which is that, if I took your current mix column as an example, 6.63 minus 2.1 gets you 4.53, and that's the real return. And then we looked at what the numbers of that are in your actuarial figures. The actuary has an inflation rate of 3.25%. And an actuarial interest rate of 7.75%, so with a real return of 4.5%. So you can one of the things you can look at is compare real returns, or you can take the SIS real return and add the actuary's inflation rate kind of to compare nominal returns. And so what you'll see is that.
And you're saying in our document, we have a 3.25%, our Graham's group is, it's 216. I cannot figure out how to turn the alarm off on my watch every day. 216 on the dot. Sorry. So we assume a 3.25% inflation rate in our document?
Yes.
You look to the next page.
And it's one of the actuarial assumptions.
And you're saying that we shouldn't really care about the 7.75%. We should care about inflation and a real return. And that's more clearly identified as to what we should be focused on, not necessarily 7.75%, but what a real return is.
Correct.
Over a real inflation rate, not a projected inflation rate that we've been using.
Yeah, because that's it's a big difference.
Yeah.
Between.
Yeah. So if inflation's run 2%, we really don't need to achieve 7.75%.
You can have actuarial gains.
Right, because what's going to happen is they've got a bunch of actuarial assumptions. And so if they're assuming that average pay is going to grow by 3.25%, and it grows more like average inflation, which everybody expects as, not everybody, but the expectation is 2, that means if payroll is not going to increase as much, therefore the long-term benefits you're going to have to pay those people is going to be less, and you will generate actuarial gains year after year after year, if that comes to pass. Okay?
So these are all assumptions.
They are all
They're
assumptions.
They're running on assumptions. You're projecting an assumption.
Right.
What's the bottom line?
The bottom line
to this report, because, I mean, this is all
right.
Great, and I would love for this to happen. But.
Right. The bottom line is this isn't going to happen. That's the first thing I could tell you.
Right.
Okay? This is what we think is going, what we believe will happen over the next 20, 30 years.
So these are 20 to 30 year projections.
Exactly. Okay, so.
I hope you're right on inflation.
Well, okay. I'll come back to that point. But these are long-term, they're expectations, and the one thing I could tell you is that this will not come true. Okay, if I said 30 years from now and kind of let's put 10 bucks on the table, you know, I know this is not going to, because the markets are completely uncertain.
Yeah, because it's like 100 to give me what's 10 today.
Yeah, exactly, or more. So I think the bottom line is we look at this and saying the real return and what you've got in your actual assumptions are close enough that we believe that this mix will allow you to meet your long-term investment objectives and and give you the net result in anything. There won't be any surprises if this were to come true. Okay, that's about a bad way of saying it, but it's more of the markets will change. So, but we're saying on an expectational basis, we believe if this mix will reflect what you're trying to do on the actual side of the
equation. Is that like more of a worst case scenario?
There's always worst case scenarios in which this return, you know, this, because if you go back to the crisis, this portfolio would have lost you 30% of your money.
Right. So
okay.
The next comment should, like your group, if we go back to the 1970s and we go sideways in the markets, 6-7% annual rate of return in a diversified portfolio, right, during the 70s, and we have inflation like we had in the 70s, 7-8%, 9%, whatever year you pick, higher in some years, then we've really lost money for a decade, and not just a little bit of money.
A lot.
We would have gone backwards in a very meaningful way. So how do we, in your document, figure out, from our actuaries, like, how bad is it if we have a 1970s?
Right. Okay. That usually is what you do in an asset liability study, is look at, and that's what we would do, is say, okay, here's what we expect, but here's all the bad things that could happen as well. So if we went through an inflationary environment, if we went through a crisis again, you know, how bad can things get? And that's part of that process.
So I think something that would be extremely helpful, no offense, this is great, but it's not helpful, because we, this is a forward-looking document, and we do have history to draw from. If we can build what our expected asset allocation is, which we've done, and we could do a best and worst-case scenario, so, like we talked about before, enough capture, down capture report, as well as some Monte Carlos.
Yep.
Right, if we could run a Monte Carlo simulation that showed, based on your current asset allocation, over 1,000 time trials, this is the high, the mid, and the low, based on this portfolio.
Right, and that's embedded in the software, and it's just, it would be...
We have more extensive reports that can...
We can do that.
We can show, and that would probably be of big interest to you.
I think it would be extremely helpful to the whole group.
Sure.
If, because then we have history that we're drawing on to show you, based on the set coordinates and the current wind, where the ship would actually be blown to.
Right.
Right. And that'll give us the, if 7.75 is real, and what the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s and the last decade and the current day and the 1920s, all that stuff kind of scrambled eggs together, what our best shot would have been, our average shot, and what it would have been like on the worst end. Because if we're looking 50 years down the road, which is the promise that we make, or that we're trying to keep that the employers have made, right, is the CEO's office and the sheriff's department and everybody else have made these promises that we're going to pay these retirees for the rest of their life, at least we'll be able to see where we would have gone given the current asset allocation model and historical events that would have occurred.
Mm-hmm.
So two things, Jason. One is that Graham's actually going to bring a tool with him next time he comes that'll kind of give you an idea of those things. The second thing is that when we did the strategic plan a couple years ago, one of the things that the board brought up, and I don't think you had been on the board that by then, was this very issue that you're discussing. In this year's strategic, in this year's goals that are geared towards addressing those issues in the strategic plan, we plan on bringing to you at some point in time for the years out a quarterly report that'll pretty much do exactly what you're saying. We'll be able to look at different scenarios based on our asset allocation today, based on our liability structure. We'll be able to look at different scenarios, different times from the past, and visually look at the risk and see what kind of risk we're actually taking at that point in time, throwing in different market scenarios, like I said, like we've seen in the past. We'll be able to get an idea of the risk that we're really under.
Well, and that's what a Monte Carlo would do for
exactly.
us, along with an asset allocation model.
Exactly. One of the things, though, that I caveat this when I say this is that it's really easy to look at the risk, to judge the risk that we're taking in different market scenarios, but it's extremely difficult to convince the powers that be that there are necessary changes that are needed, even though we see that. That's probably the most difficult thing that I see, that I've seen in my career, is that, yeah, we look at the risk and we acknowledge that we're taking it, but what are we going to do? But that's not going to stop us from looking at the risk. I think it's a very good exercise to do at least once a quarter. So we do plan on doing that.
Great. I look forward to seeing it.
But given the way the markets have behaved in the last 10 years, is the past really prologue?
That's the key, is whenever you're doing this, you know, you don't know what the future will hold. That's why we do Monte Carlo through this, to say, well, Monte Carlo brings up things that we don't even think about, but it gives you outlier kind of events. If we're reasonably, if our estimates about uncertainty are reasonable, we can come up with, we don't know what the event that causes it, but we can actually look at bad outcomes, you know, things like the financial crisis, but they might be, in the future, it's going to be something different. Okay? But you could still look at them all. You look at the financial crisis, you look at Monte Carlo to get you an idea of what you think could bad events could be.
That's why every investment company has the caveat, past performance is not necessarily a predictor of future gains.
Jason, I gotta clarify.
I just wonder what the value is of looking at 20 years ahead when you can't figure out what's gonna happen tomorrow.
Well, I think it's the exercise is allowing us to show relative changes in risk between other asset classes. You're right, but we by no means want to be blinded by the illusion of precision. That said, it's a healthy exercise and allows us to look how risk and interaction between asset classes is changing. And that's the takeaway here. I think we can take away three things. Expect lower returns from the assets that are in the portfolio. Expect lower inflation going forward. And I think we have moved as
lower than we have now?
Right. First, it's historical means, for historical averages. 2.1%, as John, this is probably a perfect time to talk about our lunchtime discussion on the 30-year implied inflation rate.
Right. If you get, you know, that's, you talk about inflation, so I just went to the markets, and the markets actually give you an estimate of inflation, because you can look at a 30-year nominal treasury bond and what is the yield on that, and you can look at an equivalent 30-year inflation protected bond. So the really the difference between those two is it's a U.S. government security. One is going to pay you something plus inflation, and one is going to pay you, you know, that a long-term expectation of nominal yield. People will take the difference between those two and say that's essentially the implied inflation rate for that period of time. Currently, that difference is 1.7% for 30 years.
Yeah, 30 years.
Implied is what the market rate at this point in time is basically saying the 30-year inflation rate's going to be.
And the last point
I'm not saying I agree with it. Well, I'm, you know, it's hard for argue with the market because it's priced, thousands of millions of people are pricing it daily. But that's kind of, you know, so there's things like that that suggest that inflation is going to be a lot less than what it has been historically.
Fear has a funny way of pricing things.
Right. And I'd say that's right now. But that number has never really been much above 2.5 for the last probably 5 years.
As Rick said at the beginning, this is for information and discussion. I think, you know, that's an important thing that we look at this so that we get a sense from how we're thinking about the future. And this is a discussion we want to keep having because it's healthy, it's positive. Real return matters. This portfolio has migrated into more assets that focus on real return. We're making those steps slowly but surely in things like infrastructure. To some extent, you know, real estate is in that category. But we're going to keep marching, keep making dedicated decisions that are going to do what we set out to do.
Jason, I want to clear something up really fast. I said something incorrect. Those tools that we are going to be using to analyze risk to the portfolio, to employer contribution rates, to fund status, those aren't on tap until next year. So that's not this year, that's next year. Sorry.
And that's fine. A simple up capture Monte Carlo calculation. I mean, I have to assume you guys have all that stuff in-house and ready to rip.
Yes.
Right. But yeah. I think Graham is probably, at this point, the better person to ask to weigh in on that because he knows our liability structure more intimately than these guys do. Right. So he could probably take their capital market expectations.
We don't have at the final valuation report. You'll see a projection of the contribution funded ratio under sort of the median assumption, and then we'll show distributions, right? So your 40th to 60th percentile investment returns will be a band of a certain color, and then we'll see, you know, wider bands as you go further out the distribution. So, you know, when you get to the fifth to 95th percentile in terms of your returns, you're really good, you're 120 good, you're 120 bad scenarios. You'll see what those contribution rate and funded ratios look like projected out, you know, 10, 20 years. So, and we can change the standard deviations and you can see how that affects the distribution. So that's something we will bring to your next meeting. We're also, we've got for Rick a risk dashboard at CalIPERS Administrators Institute a few months ago, and that's something we're gonna be showing to a number of our clients this year too, which has a lot of the same information.
Before we go on really fast, I want to call out on page 2 the change in the infrastructure expected returns and just spend just a minute or two telling us why that's gone down by 110 basis points, especially in light of the fact that we haven't committed any dollars to that space yet.
And this is, I mean, infrastructure is an asset class that we've refined the expectations. It's a fairly new asset class, so it's got bigger uncertainty around it. But it's also an asset class that has garnered a lot of interest and a lot of cash flows. And so this is more of part of the expectation is that it's less attractive now than it was a while ago, primarily because of interest in cash flows. And despite that reduction in return, if I was to run an asset model and let it pick the asset classes it wanted, infrastructure would be an asset class that it would want because there's diversifying effects, inflation protection effects that the model wants within a portfolio. So like I said, so despite its reduction in return, it's still got desirable attributes and is a good thing to have in a portfolio.
Also, the vehicle that we've been looking at is private in nature. So there's an illiquidity premium that's available that we would be invested in, which would certainly increase that return expectation. Also, this is being driven, the assumption is being driven by public equivalents. And so we're talking about private market vehicles, which have a different risk profile to some extent. But when we look at this, we don't want to talk about, none of this has any alpha expectations in it. This is just simply looking at asset classes stripped away at their pure essential characteristics, risk return correlation. Great.
Question?
The Fed is still thinking 2%, right?
Target for inflation?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have a dual mandate, and they want, it's easier for them to have an inflation around there. And so, the other part being jobs.
Yeah. But I think their time frame is much different.
We're talking 6 months?
Well, that's a...
6 months, a year, a couple of years.
Yeah. Just 2 days ago, was that they're still planning. They're still staying with their strategy.
Right.
For a 2%
right.
inflation rate.
That's a good segue. Thank you for bringing that question up to market performance. Can we talk about that? Are we there yet? Should we segue? So talking about that, taking that to the next step is that the dramatic fall in oil has some deflationary components to it. And some are speculating whether this dramatic price decline in oil may in fact delay the Fed from deciding to raise rates. Now, that's speculation, but there are market forces that are going to continue to influence exactly when the Fed will raise rates. But they have stuck to guidance, you're right, around that particular time frame. The market, though, is betting otherwise. If you look at market participants and where they think Feds are going to raise the rates, they're not so sure.
And I find it amusing that there's so much bad news on the lower fuel rate.
That is interesting, certainly. And that's the second story in the last year is to look at how the U.S. has continued to grow versus the rest of the world, who has really struggled with growth. We've seen markets, let's actually turn to the first page of the December performance report. This is the new format. This page should look very similar. It has the index returns, 6B.
November?
December, please. Let's go to December, since that's more relevant. November was a good month, 1.5% return portfolio. So looking at the December returns, it offers several dynamics that are helpful, not only the trailing year, but the year-to-date, which is on our fiscal year cycle. I'm going to highlight two different columns primarily, the one-month column and the one-year column. If we look at the one-month column, starting up top with U.S. equity indices, we see 0% return for the Russell 3000. But the story is much more dramatic underneath that. you have the large caps providing a negative return, anywhere from down 25 basis points to down 1%, and small cap being a strong performer, up nearly 3% for the 2000 growth. But all that changes, and it is inverted when we look at the one-year return. The S&P 500 returning nearly 13.5%, where the small cap indexes are down relative to the large cap, up just under 5%, 4.89% for the Russell 2000 index. Now, a good year, but the story is completely different for the rest of the world. If we look at the ACWI ex-US, down 3.4% for the year, and the emerging markets down 1.82% for the year. When we look at the currencies, the euro, the yen, down over 12% for the year. The US dollar against a basket of currencies up over 10% a year. Now that has a direct inverse relationship to the emerging markets. When the US currency is weak, the emerging markets are strong. When the US dollar is strong, the emerging markets are usually quite weak. And for large corporations that have a lot of exposures to the international landscape, this is a headwind. And so we're going to see this story continue to play out in 2015. We've already seen as much. Microsoft came out today, rattled the markets down significantly. A lot of that has to do, about 4% of growth has to do with their international exposure and the currency impact that they're facing. So there are divergence in central banking, central planning policy on how they're affecting the currencies. A silent leader over the last year was the U.S. REITs, housing REIT markets, up 32%. I mean, that's a staggering, impressive return, and something that didn't get a lot of airway, I suppose. Something that definitely was on the other side of that was commodities, down 15% for the Dow Jones UBS Commodity Index. Certainly oil is playing a part on that. Something that's beginning to reverse trend is gold. We're seeing QE start to come in place. Europe looking to introduce quantitative easing, potentially a catalyst for a return as far as the Eurozone is concerned with growth. Gold is looking again to be somewhat interesting when it comes to its relationship to central banking and quantitative easing. Let's go ahead and flip to the next page to look at how our portfolio has responded in light of these interesting happenings. So the first page looks at our portfolio from a dollar point, current allocation compared to target policy. You can see we have an overweight to U.S. equities that's been a holding block for things like real estate, direct lending. That has been a positive. The fact that we've decided to allow that exposure to run is certainly added to the total portfolio in real dollars that we'll get to in two more pages. But as we look at, as it stands at the end of December, we're tracking around a 2.3% underweight to direct lending, 1.7% underweight to real estate, fixed income underweight roughly 2%, international equities down our target by around 1.2%, and domestic equities has the lion's share around 10% above what we are working towards the future target asset allocation. Page three, this is shows how things have progressed from the prior month. Page three. Two things to highlight. I mentioned real estate. You can see that 32% change in our portfolio's real estate valuations from a year prior. That almost tracks identically to the index that highlighted that 32% return. Very nice. Very nice. From the month prior, when we look at the total portfolio dollar value, down around $3.4 million. But when we look from a prior year, after everything, expenses, the fund's value has risen $81.5 million. That's nice. That's very helpful. Page four, we'll get into the portfolio. And I'll do two things. I'll talk about the month, how the last month, what happened with some of our managers, but also allude to some larger market changes. So,
Nate, real quick, you said that we had an $80+ million change in value. And I see that.
Yep.
Is that all return, or is there a contribution in that number?
It's everything.
Return plus net cash flow.
It's a real dollar change.
Do we know how much the cash flow was?
We pay about $80 million, $80 million a year in benefits. And contributions are about $40 million. So there's a $40 million drag on the portfolio in dollars.
So it's actually better than 80. It's $120 million in excess return, or in return.
It's a good year.
Yep.
You're welcome, Graham.
Good job.
Page four, we look at the total fund portfolio for the month of December, down 33 basis points. This compares to the policy index, down 38 basis points, or a 5% difference. I like to kind of do a back of the envelope comparison, how a 60-40 portfolio might do of global stocks and bonds. And such a portfolio for the month of December would have been down negative 1.4%. And so the diversification that we've been moving towards is certainly helping. So a down 30 basis points, never like that. I never want to see anything down. But when we compare it to a relative passive index, which is a common proxy, it looks quite a bit better, about 100 basis points better. Our U.S. equity portfolio allocation up 45 basis points compared to its blended index of 38 basis points. We can see the primary contributors are coming from Jackson Square, Legato slightly, and our asset allocation exposure to large and small. We see Dodge & Cox kind of having a real strong year, 2014 in total, but the latter part of the year trailing its benchmark. You can see the far right column gives that perspective over the previous 6 months, down roughly 120 basis points. Legato up for the month and for the fiscal year. Conversely, Capital Prospects down for the month, but also over the fiscal year, up roughly 97 basis points. Flipping the page to the fixed income portfolio, international and fixed income portfolio, we can see for the month down negative 3.22%. This is not fixed income, this is the international equity portfolio, which continues the story that we looked at on page one, how the rest of the world outside the U.S. Stubbing their toe, per se. Down negative 3.22%, which favorably compares to our policy index, down negative 3.57, or 35 basis points difference. The managers LSV and Pyramus kind of have swapped places. One manager down, LSV, Pyramus up. That net-net provided 35 basis points of outperformance for the month. The fixed income allocation, down slightly 7 basis points compared to the Barclays ads, slightly up 9 basis points. The broader story there is when you look at the one-year return for the U.S. Barclays, around 6%. It's kind of interesting. That's not a bad return for the Barclays ag. You saw interest rates, most part of the market, come down over the year. The global picture was a bit different. The number, do you remember the number we talked about at lunch for the global Barclays ag, which is not included in this report? It's about
six.
It's a little bit less than that, but yeah, right in that picture. The U.S. bond market definitely preferred to be invested in that segment over the last year versus the global bond market. And the real estate sector, we had a REIT exposure for the primary part of the year, passive REIT exposure, which was just fine. Gave us the exposure we wanted to the asset class and a very healthy return. We have since started moving into two private funds, partners with Greenfield and American Realty. And we're beginning to see those investments start to enter the portfolio. Direct lending has provided, as Rick astutely highlighted when we met earlier today, diversification benefits and is helping to provide an alternative exposure that's giving a return that's at the moment targeting 9%. You can see from our capital market expectations that's something we're going to reconsider, revisit as the market dynamics have changed and a more conservative expectation going forward is merited. And it's fair to say that the benchmark might need to be looked at and worked at as we consider additional investments. We're at a 4.5% allocation to that space, which trails the 7.5% target. And we're also, towards the end of the year, we'll need to kind of consider revisiting this space and make new commitments in order to make sure that that allocation is in line with the targets that we put in place with the asset liability study.
Nate, I got a question. Page five, the real estate, the aggregate, it shows 8.19 fiscal year to date, and then 11.61 as the bench.
Yes.
Where is that coming from when I look at the next page and BlackRock performed very close to?
Yeah, I need to look at that.
Yeah.
That's a good point. That might be.
Didn't make sense.
Yeah, let me look at that. Right. I'm not sure when we got out of Invesco, but I need to take a look at that.
The global ag is down 121.
Say it again?
Is down 121.
The global ag, I mean, that's a huge difference. The US ag up 6%, and the global bond market's down 121, so.
But that'll be, a lot of that'll be the current, again, the currency exposure, which is loss of 10 to 15%.
Strengthening dollar.
Strengthening dollar, I mean, it's a good thing we're not in it, but.
But that's the thing that's helped with international for the last decade.
Say it again?
For the last decade, we've had the benefit of that in the international market.
Dollar kind of weakening.
A weak dollar versus European currency specific and Asian.
A global stock bond portfolio for the 2014 returned a passive exposure, global stocks and bonds returned 3%. It's a cliffhanger, but my guess is when we do the quarterly report next time, we beat that, which is a positive thing for us to keep in mind as we consider how our portfolio is influenced. So what's next? We look into the future. I think the themes that we're going to really be interested in how they play out, the Fed, Joan so accurately highlighted, how are they going to continue to influence the markets? How are the European central banks going to influence the markets? We've seen in the last weeks quantitative easing being something that they're now introducing. Is that the catalyst that's going to turn their markets around? We'll see. We have Greece that's creating havoc. We have this Russian story that is not going away. In fact, it might be increasing in intensity, where we saw yesterday the European Union come out with very strict words against the actions that took place last week in the Ukraine, 30 civilian deaths, talking about increasing sanctions. The ruble is free for all, down 50-60% if you look over the last 12 months. Their central bank has no more bullets left in their chambers. They have increased rates, their interest rate to nearly 17%. This is a story that I really think is worth following. The markets.
And oil destroyed them.
Oil has, absolutely. It's a commodity. It's a country that's just based on the profitability in that commodity. And it's been a year that this story has been in the markets. And to some extent, the average news reader is getting used to just the controversy over there. But how it plays out with their current political regime, there's a lot of unknowns in place. And so,
but it's not likely to be a positive scenario.
I would say, assuming things
point of view.
Move to their logical conclusion, no, not positive. So we're hoping intervention of some sort.
I have a question along those lines.
Sure.
You know, we've been reading the newspaper or in the articles for a long time, over the last several months about the Greece elections in Greece, saying that the anti-Euro party might win. And this weekend they would.
Yep.
Right, and now they have a new government. Did our managers, do they have any strategies to anticipate that, to prepare for it? And if so, what were they and what did they do? And do you monitor it? Does anyone monitor it? Or do we just all sit and take punches? Greece,
so,
Ukraine, et cetera.
It's a great question.
Is there like do we know what these guys are doing? And are they on top of things? Are we confident that their anticipation?
Yeah.
I mean,
most of the managers you have, you know, first I'll say from a capital market perspective, the size of the Greece market is tiny.
But if the EU goes down.
Right, and that's where I think you've seen an effect, where it's like, okay, this has more of an effect on what is the price of the euro over the short term, okay? Yeah, but there have been a lot of things going on with the euro and currencies in Europe and the dollar that, you know, Greece is just one factor. And I think the managers, some of them will say they don't have the capabilities to manage currencies effectively. Okay. But as far as are they following the political events and how that impacts companies, of course they are. That's what they'll do. But I would say that it hasn't been a significant impact, just because it's not, you know, nobody's going into Greece with a lot of exposure. The short answer is yes, the managers are actively looking at where can they take advantage of what the marketplace is offering them.
I think if we were investing in private infrastructure that was purchasing specific assets in that particular region of the world, ports, airports, they're going to be highly influenced by the political regime. That kind of risk exposure is meaningful.
I just want to know, do you guys have a confidence level that our managers are, you know, trying to have innovative strategies to anticipate events? That's all.
Yes. Short answer is yes.
You are confident that our guys...
The two managers in particular with those exposures, LSV and Pyramus.
Right.
Greece is actually an emerging market country. So the ACWI index has around 10%, and it fluctuates, of emerging market exposure. And of the emerging markets, Greece is by no means one of the top contributors to the index's performance. So the broader question, which I think you're alluding to, is what's the ripple? What's the second, third, higher level impact of this,
right,
this kind of Greece impact? And it's got to be up top, because it's on the front pages and it has influence to the markets. And so I think we need to be thinking about this not just in the context of those two managers that are investing dollars into the country, but it's got to be up there when we think about the total portfolio. And so it's an important question.
The answer might actually be they're taking advantage of this in the way that you might not think is appropriate, because they may just think that, you know, the headlines create uncertainty, you know, stocks get hammered, and that is an opportunity to start investing in Greece.
Actually, I would want them to be doing that.
Yeah, and they will be. And that is part of their process for all these, is looking at what's out there, where are the opportunities.
So you know that they have a strategy to take care of localized, if you want to call it that.
That's part of what they do.
You guys are on top of that. That's...
And do they feel that the drachmas I have in my drawer?
No. That, I haven't specifically asked them of what
on
that
day
is.
One of trading, they'll be devalued 50%. Worry about day two of trading if that happens.
Mike, one thing that I can tell you is, at least the last time I looked, and it was probably 2 or 3 months ago, we had very little exposure to Greece in this portfolio. Right.
We had one company.
Yeah, it wasn't so much Greece, my question,
right,
but if they pull out of the EU and the whole right thing kind of collapses, the house
but
of cards.
It's not just exposure to Greece.
No, no,
it's
I understand.
What Greece
absolutely
could do to the common market of Euro.
That's right.
I just want to know if these guys have, if it's more than just, you know, what some people do over here. You know, you take the top 30 companies and you keep your stuff in there and you switch it around periodically. Are they looking beyond that at more dramatic events that are obviously occurring in Europe?
Yep. That's what you paint, yeah. Yes.
If they just set their coordinates and they were at the beckoning, you know, the risk of which way the wind's going to blow, they would never attract new dollars. And they're just an index. And let's pay them 6 or 7 basis points to be an index. But to really be an active manager and earn and keep, they have to kind of be ahead of the storm.
Okay.
Or take advantage when there is a storm. And I think that's really what you're interested in.
Yeah, right. I want our guys
yeah
to be making some money.
Yeah,
me too.
So you're not worried
I'm glad
about
you're on
the
Greeks. This board. We should be sitting here trying to figure out how we can infuse capital into Greece so we can make money.
But I think what you mentioned earlier about
there could
infrastructure.
Be, there could be some banks in Europe that are looking to offset some Greek debt at for less than par, I would guess.
But in the grand scheme of our portfolio, it'd be like Salida going broke. You know, it's like it impacts Salida, but it doesn't impact the United States.
Anybody live in Salida here?
Well, I mean, Stockton. Just the U.S. markets are not going to mind that Stockton went bankrupt.
That would impact me, but.
All right.
Anyway, so we're.
Top 10.
Hey, Letterman.
We can go fast through it. They're pretty benign as far as activity when it looks at active management. A couple large movements. We can see the first page takes a look at the large cap value portfolio. Large cap growth portfolio, the passive index manager. You have six issues in the top 10 down, which makes sense. We've seen the total market month to date down. So surprisingly, only 1.2%. NASDAQ, down 80 bips. It seems like there's a lot more volatility in the market than what's actually reflected in the total returns. We're just used to, I guess, last year, much more sanguine, easygoing markets. Large cap value, five issues down out of the 10. Pretty straightforward. If you look at S&P, same story. Five securities down, half up, half down, compared to its appropriate benchmark. Dodge and Cox, two things of interest. You see the banks, the banking sector in general, has had a tough month to date. You see Bank of America, they're 10th holding in their top 10, down 12%. Converse that, a pretty strong performance from Novartis, up around 11%. You go to Jackson Square, been a strong performer. They're holding in Allergan, the pharmaceutical company, up relative 400 basis points month to date. Celgene also up pretty good. And Crown Castle doing well, four securities down, but those that are up offsetting that. And this report really, I think, something to highlight, reminder, Jackson Square, they're concentrated. So when we look at the top 10 holdings, it really matters a lot more with a manager like Jackson Square than some of these others. Perfect example, Capital Prospects. You can see their total weightings in their top 10 only amount to 10% of the total portfolio. So they have six securities down compared to the 10, but again, see some offsetting. Legato, two interesting stories. LifeLock had a tough announcement, earning guidance, down 20%. Acorn, on the other end of that, up just under 16%, energy-related company. And then the two international managers, LSV, had three securities down, Magna International. I mean, what's hard about this security is I'm not sure exactly when they got into that particular position. As they give me this update on a monthly basis, there can be interactions that occur. So while this shows down 13% for the number one holding, the reality is the return on that particular stock could be different. But this is a snapshot to give us some kind of guidance. We look at Pyramus. It had four securities down compared to the top 10 holdings. And again, about 12% of the total portfolio is in those top 10 holdings. And a couple of interesting positions there. And that's that. The last is just index returns.
Hope Jackson Square got out of Microsoft yesterday.
Is that right?
I just hope they did.
Oh.
Because it took a tumble this morning.
It did, yeah. I know that is a company that Jackson Square generally thinks quite favorably of long term. And it's risen a lot in the last 12 months.
Apple reported some pretty nice.
Yeah, 38%. Beat its revenues by 38%, stock up around 5% after hours. People like larger iPhones.
This is it.
Look at that. Do you like it?
Yeah.
Me too.
Back to the future.
This is a 6, it's not the 6 Plus.
I regret not getting the 6 Plus.
However, if you buy at the AT&T store, they will also sell you a new security system for your house, even though you have one that's not working.
You're saying you bought one?
Yes.
Okay. They did more than offer it. You acted on it.
Yeah. Yeah. Good deal.
Thank you, Nate. John?
All right. Okay.
All right. Well, Graham migrates up to the front there for item 7A. Let me just tell you what this is. This is a discussion and action item regarding the preliminary June 30th, 2014 actuarial evaluation. So today, after Graham speaks and we pepper him with questions, we will ask you to take a vote on whether we send Graham back home and have him perform the actual evaluation as we see it here in the preliminary result, or if we send him back home and ask him to make some changes to that and bring us back something different. So that's what this item is about. Mr. Schmidt.
Do you want any of the, because they don't have the spreadsheet, do you?
No.
If everybody's comfortable going questions. Off the handouts, yeah, we can just do this.
If we get some questions, then we can bring that up.
Sorry for making you guys set the projector up.
Not a problem.
Okay.
You so, test it once in a while anyway, so that's good.
Good to see you all. Another year has passed. I have way more gray hair and a second child. But other than that, there's good things in the actuarial evaluation report. This is a preliminary look at the results as of 6/30/2014. So remember, we do a snapshot every year where we look at your assets and your liabilities. And when I say your liabilities, we look at everybody that's in the plan or receiving a benefit as of June 30th, 2014. We'll talk about what those results show so far, some changes since the last valuation, have some charts just as where you've been historically. We're going to talk about next steps. And of course, you know, I'm the actuary. I can't just bring a report that's nothing but positive news. So I'll give you the expected anchor to that later on in the report. But if you turn to slide two, which is, or page two, the summary of key valuation results. Not really much change in terms of the liabilities. Liabilities went up pretty much how we expected them to. It was as of June 30th, 2013, the liabilities were just over $1.9 billion. As of June 30th, 2014, just over $2 billion. The actuarial value of assets, remember that's the smooth value of assets where we're deferring gains and losses in the asset value, 80% of them, we're only recognize a fifth of the gains in the current year. That actuarial value of assets went up from just over $1.5 billion to $1.6 billion. So your unfunded liability, your assets, your liabilities minus your assets actually declined this year. Yay. $395 million down to $380 million. So your funded ratio on a smooth basis increased by a couple percent up to 81%. One thing that's happened too in the last year is we implemented the new GASB standards, GASB 67, 68. You remember we brought a report that had all those results, and one of the things there was all funded statuses now for your disclosure statements are going to be based on that market value of assets. So we're not using that smooth asset value for your financial disclosure statements in your CAFR. We have always presented you with the market value funded ratio in your funding reports as well, but I think we're going to start highlighting that number more than the smooth number going forward. That number improved quite a bit, right? The unfunded liability dropped from just under $400 million to about $250 million because you had such good investment returns. Thanks, guys. So on that basis, your funded ratio improved significantly because the market value of assets went up by quite a bit. So it went up from just under 80% to funded ratio of almost 88%, 76.5% this year. That's one of the higher ones I've seen in the 37 Act systems. Net employer contribution rate, I have a rate here, 24%. You may remember that last year the employers actually were paying less than that, just under 23%, because we were phasing in the impact of some changes we made in line with the GASB standards in terms of your actual funding policy. But if we had, ignoring the phase-in yet last year, the contribution rate would have been 24% of pay. That actually went down to 23.3% of pay. So that's the first time in years I've gotten to give those results of a declining employer contribution rates. Highlights on the next page, again, the highlight.
Can I ask a question just to,
sure.
Back on that page. So if I look at the difference between the market value of assets and the actuarial value of assets, that means there's about $130 million saved away for a rainy day.
That is correct.
All right.
Yep.
Very good.
If you look on the next page, return was 18% net of investment, but not administrative expenses. That's one of the changes we made compared to the 7.75% return. The return on the smooth value of assets was just under 9.4, so it was a $25 million gain in terms of the recognized portion, which reduced the contribution rates by about 0.75% of pay. That's really the whole story in terms of the contribution rate changes. There are about $120 million in deferred asset gains. The number there is slightly different from what you referred to, Rick, because we're looking at the ones outside of the non-valuation reserves, the contingency reserves. Again, we phased in you phased in these cost impacts of these funding method changes over a two-year period. Last year, you phased in about 1% of pay. This year, you phase in the other percent of that. So the contribution rate went up by 1.06% as you phased in the second half of those actuarial method changes this year. And that was expected. If you look back at last year's report, we actually said, here's what we project the contribution rate to be this year. And we said it was going to be about 24% of pay, right? It's 23.3%. So almost the entire difference between what we had projected last year of 24 and what you got, that's the investment gains from this year. Net impact of everything else, nothing, right? Retirements, deaths, disabilities, salary increases, all those things amounted to not much at all, about 0.1% of pay. We did have some salaries increasing a little faster than expected in terms of the overall payroll base, but again, not much going on. Your current unfunded liability method is to amortize the unfunded liability as a level percentage of payroll, so we expect that the payments are going to go up in dollar terms every year as pay goes up. That was a 23-year period under your current policy. That would drop to 22 years this year. Now, 22 years, based on your current assumptions, is still what we would call negative amortization, right? The payment that the employers are making on the unfunded liability is still less than the interest on the unfunded at 7.75%. Even if all of our assumptions are made, that means that it means that the dollar amount of the unfunded liability is expected to increase slightly, but your funded ratio is expected to improve, right? Because both your assets and your liabilities are growing, and your assets are growing faster than your liabilities, okay?
So Graham, the 22 years that you quote, is that as of the valuation date?
That is as of June 30, 2014.
Right.
So if we don't make any changes to our policy, that's what I would be using this year to calculate the payment.
Right, but then when we start this next fiscal year, 15-16, we'll be at 21 during that year.
Well, we compute the number of years based on the valuation date, and then those rates get deferred a year before they are implemented.
Do you include a 22-year amortization payment on the unfunded liability when you project it forward to the next fiscal year?
Yes.
Okay.
If you look at the next page, this just summarizes all those changes in terms of the contribution rates. And in this chart, we actually started with what you were actually asking the employers to contribute last year, which was the 22.94%. So that's after the phase in of the method changes. And again, that was pretty much flat. I mean, it only went up by less than 0.4% of pay to 23.3. And your contribution rate right now is almost evenly split between the normal cost and the amortization payment. So about half of the contributions being made now are to pay for the benefits that members are currently earning, and then the other half is to pay for unfunded liability, mostly for shortfalls in the investment returns going back through the last couple of financial crises. Remember, we do also have an explicit charge for the expected administrative expenses for the current year, and that's about 0.9% of pay. Any questions on how we got from last year to this year? Terms of costs. Okay. Slides 5, 6, and 7 are really just historical pictures. 5 is showing you a comparison of the liabilities, which is the gray bar, compared with the market and the smooth value of assets. We used to always show those funded ratios. I mean, in your GASB reports, that used to show those funded ratios under the smooth value. We're replacing that in these charts with the market value, because I think that's what we're going to focus on going forward. And we're showing you at the bottom what was the unfunded liability amount in dollar terms. And that's been, actually, it's come down since 2009, right? It was almost $500 million, and now it's down under $400 million as of 2014. Contribution rates, both for the employee and the employer, are shown on slide 6. Again, this is the 2013 results here are ignoring the phase-in, so you see a slight decline in the contribution rate for the employer. The employee rates generally are trending up a little bit as PEPRA members come in, right? They're paying half the normal costs. They're not, no pickups for future employees. So you'll see that rate come up as current members get replaced by new hires. The next chart is showing gains and losses, and I don't want to spend too much time on this other to point out that not a whole lot has gone on the last couple of years compared to what we were looking at in 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009, right? Those big asset losses and then gains as you snapped back from the downturns, all those things. We've just seen a lot less in terms of volatility in your liabilities and your assets the last few years. You did some, you see that asset, I don't know, I'm colorblind, is that yellow or green that's gold. Above? Gold?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's a gain, right, on the assets, and you had a very small loss in the liabilities. In terms of what the next steps are, we need to finalize the valuation results. the results that I've shared with you are preliminary. They're still going through our peer review. One thing we found was a handful of people that had some individuals that had slightly larger than losses than we expected once they retired. So we're going to be working with staff just to look at those benefit calculations to make sure that we're comfortable with those numbers. It could be that those are issues in terms of retirees that may have cashed out some vacation time at the end of their career, which I believe is still allowed for some of the legacy members. Once that is complete, we'll come back with the finalized June 30th, 2014 actuarial evaluation, which will have the fiscal year 15-16 contribution rates for both the employees and the employers. Remember, the employee rates for PEPRA members, those are tied to the normal costs, so we have to recompute those every year. Generally, the employee contribution rates for legacy members, those only will change when we change our actuarial assumptions.
Say that again.
The contribution rates for pre-PEPRA members, those are based on these formulas in the CERL that say that a member has to somebody who's hired at age 30 has to pay an amount that would accumulate to an annuity of 1% of pay at age 60. So that calculation is based on forward-looking assumptions. What do we expect returns to be? What do we expect mortality to be? And if the assumptions don't change from year to year, then then those contribution rates don't change year to year. Whereas for PEPRA members, their contribution rate is defined as half of the normal costs. And remember, when we say normal costs, we mean the cost of the benefits that people are earning this year. And we recalculate that number every year based on what's your population, right? If you're hiring people at earlier ages, that will tend to reduce the normal cost because you have more time to fund those benefits. So because PEPRA members, they all pay an average amount, we have to compute it for the people that are actually in your plan each year. Does that make sense?
Okay. So even though we know there's an unfunded liability, we're still required to reduce the contribution rate.
You mean the overall contribution rate that we computed? If you're required to, based on the current policy and the current amortization period that you have, when we compute the normal costs plus the unfunded liability payment this year, that number is less than it would have been last year, ignoring that phase-in, because the unfunded liability this year is smaller than it was last year.
Now, are you saying that you would like to keep it at a higher level to fund some of future unfunded liability, or?
Well, I'm just wondering why, if you anticipate that the unfunded liability is going to continue, stay there, mm-hmm. why would you want, unless you had to, why would you reduce the contribution? Why not just leave it the way it is?
That's a fair question.
It comes down to the decisions that we made.
Well, and it's also part of the actuarial process. It's the way the actuarial process works. And like Graham said, we had such a good return that the process says, okay, we don't need you to contribute quite as much as you were contributing last year to pay off that unfunded liability in the time that you've planned for.
We did that when the market was raging.
No. You have a good point.
Look what happened when it stopped raging.
You make a very, very good point.
Sure, you make an excellent point that other boards are grappling with. I have a neighbor county of yours that they are considering asking the employees, telling the employer, like, look, here's what the contribution rate is this year. If our assumptions are met, we actually expect it to go down because we have deferred asset gains like you do. And their thought is, well, can we get you to just keep paying the same rate for a few years to get a little more money into the plan to reduce the unfunded liability? I will say their funded status is significantly worse than yours. So,
more what?
Worse. You're in a better funded position than this other plan.
Well, right. But if we reduce it, could we end up where they are?
We said we have to work pretty hard at it.
Pardon me?
No comment, but I'm not going to argue with.
So if this board wanted to keep the rate for 15-16, something similar to what it was in 14-15, Would the best way to go about doing that would be to lower the amortization period by 1 year?
You could.
Now, you're close.
Now, this year, the effective rate is pretty close to where it was last year, right? Actually, this year, it's a little higher than what it was last year. Last year, it was 22.9. This year, we're looking at 23.3. So we actually are, are requesting a higher percentage of pay than you did last year. Last year, you didn't request the full amount because you phased in those changes over a two-year period. So
in reality, we wouldn't be going up, say, 1.25. We'd be going up maybe 2.25.
So if you look at page 10, mm-hmm. and look at the bottom of page 10, this is what reality is. So last year, we asked our plan sponsors to pay 22.94 in the aggregate, and next year, we're going to ask them to pay 23.3. And the difference is, as Graham alluded to, is that last piece of the implementation of the GASB methodology change that we deferred last year.
Right.
So we are actually increasing the employer contribution rates by 36 basis points.
Now, as Rick pointed out, if I wouldn't say if you wanted a higher number, you could say if I think that amortization, we should pay that off over a shorter period of time, you could adopt a shorter amortization period and the contribution rate would go up. Before we go too far down that road, I want to tell you a little bit about what's coming, which is the last bullet here. The triennial experience study, right? So every 3 years by law, same page, page 8, next, still under next steps.
The bad news.
Well, you know, people are living longer, so yeah, the bad news. Right?
Okay, but...
Every 3 years by law, we review the assumptions that we use to project future liabilities, right? How much do we expect to earn? When do we expect people to retire? How much do we expect them to make? How long do we expect them to live? And I will tell you that I have had several other plans go through that exercise in the last couple of years, and they are seeing significant increases because of more conservative assumptions, in particular, mortality rates. And not necessarily that mortality has improved or that people are living that much longer right now, but the Society of Actuaries has released a new set of tables, in particular what they call mortality improvement scales. So how do we expect people, how much longer do we expect them to live in the future? How do we expect mortality to change over time? And what recent experience has shown is that it's not necessarily that everybody's living a lot longer than we expected right away, but the ages at which improvement is happening are the ages that matter most for pension plans, right? People in their 60s through their 80s are living longer, and that is leading to higher liabilities. Now, you may have known that CalPERS last year adopted new mortality tables, and they saw significant increases in liabilities and contribution rates for some safety plans as high as like 9% of pay increases in contribution rates. Another neighboring plan of yours adopted some of these assumptions last year at the same time that they reduced their inflation assumption and their expected rates of return. They saw a contribution rate increase of about 6% of pay from assumption changes. Now, they phased that in over a three-year period. I think later, Rick has been looking at this. I've been sharing some stuff with him. There are some new funding methodologies that some plans are using, something known as direct rate smoothing, where instead of using asset smoothing, we use the market value of assets and we just phase in the impact of unfunded liability changes on the contribution rates directly. That's why they call it direct rate smoothing as opposed to this actuarial value of asset voodoo, right? But the net impact of that is some plans are automatically phasing in the impact of liability changes, not just asset changes. So that would include changes to your liabilities that occur as a result of assumption changes. You've done something similar here where you adopted a method change and you elected to phase that in over a two-year period. So just to give everybody, including the guests here, a heads up that we may be, you may be looking at, and I would say you're likely going to be looking at assumptions, which would result in increased liabilities and higher contribution rates. But I think at the same time, we'll probably want to be looking at phasing in some of those impacts over a period of time.
Well, what are you talking about?
Which is my point.
4%?
I can't tell you till we actually start running the numbers for your plan in terms of mortality. I'll tell you, a one plan that reduced the discount rate and adopted these new mortality assumptions, for them, it was 6% of pay.
And that's in line with what I've been seeing out there. I've seen the mortality changes around 4 to 5%, and generally a 1/4% drop in the discount rate equates to 2.5%.
Yeah, now it depends on if you're also reducing your, remember, inflation, these guys are talking about inflation versus real returns, and thanks for that. Generally, reducing your expected real return increased your contribution rate by about double what it is if you reduce your inflation rate and your nominal return, right? So if they say, look, we can't earn 4.5% above your inflation assumption anymore, we can only earn 4.25%, that's going to increase your contribution rates by somewhere between 2 and 3% of pay. If you reduce your inflation assumption, but you keep the same real return, that will generally increase your contribution rate by somewhere between 1 and 2% of pay.
I think a good guess, Mike, would probably be in the 5 to 6% neighborhood. Can't go to town on that, but I would guess that that's going to be.
And when do we start paying that?
That would probably be 2 years from now.
So if we reflect those assumptions as part of the June 30th, 2015 valuation, which is the one we'll start working on this summer, we'll start the experience study, you know, even before that time. That would go into effect for your fiscal year 16-17 employer and employee contribution rates, because assumption changes will also change the employee rates as well.
Remember, though, if we decide to adopt this direct rate smoothing, that's going to mitigate that large impact. You're not going to see that all at once.
You'll see that if you do that, you'd see the impact on the normal cost right away, the
right.
cost of the benefits that people are earning this year, which makes sense. You know, if you know that this is the cost of what they're earning this year, you know, why would you defer that?
The bottom line is there's a big hit coming, and we probably ought not to be reducing contribution rates right now.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that kind of the bottom line?
Well,
it's a good strategy.
Or at least make sure your employers are aware of what's happening.
I'll take a contrarian point of view here on that. And here's my reasoning, okay? We have a plan. We don't know what the future impacts of the plan are going to be, but this was set up based on a decision that we made on how we were going to approach it over a long period of time. And to then just say, well, this year we're not going to do that, we're going to do something else because we want a different number. To me, I think you make a plan and you stick to your plan. And that to go away from that creates chaos and unreliable numbers over a longer period.
I would agree with what you're saying, except we have pretty good evidence from our consultants that the hit is coming. It's not like we're changing the rules of the game, and they could be good or bad returns.
But why go down 2 years instead of just going down the 1 year in the way we made our plan?
Well, it's kind of like, you know, continuing an overpayment or an underpayment when you know that you're going to get caught by the IRS guys and 18 months. You fix it, or you sooner or later you have to fix it.
Yeah, or you'll pay the penalty.
Graham,
if the board decided to do something, say lower the amortization period this year,
one thing to keep in mind is that will also increase the contribution rate next year on top of the assumption changes you're making.
That's where I was asking
right.
that question. Would it?
Because it means you're making it'll increase the cost this year, but it'll also increase the cost next year because you're saying I'm going to take 20 years instead of 21 years to pay off the remaining unfunded liability. Unless you then next year backed off that change in the unfunded liability schedule, right?
How many years are we amortizing now?
You're at 22 years for the current valuation.
Okay. Weren't we reducing that by a year, every year?
Yes, so last year it was 23 years.
So we're going to go down anyway, then, until we get to about 18 or something like that?
Well, right now, the policy is that's a closed period. So that'll just keep going down until that unfunded liability is gone. Which we need, you will need to make a decision at some point. 15 years from now, if that period was 7 years, that would be way too volatile of a plan, right? You'd have, if you had like a, you know, a market loss and you try to pay that off over 7 years, that's not going to work. So at some point, and I think we've talked about this before, this concept of layering, right? Where each year's unfunded liability, you know, the change in the unfunded liability from year to year gets its own separate amortization schedule. So you don't have just one amortization period, you have multiple multiple amortization bases that get paid off in different times.
So to address Donna's point, if, and this is a big if the board decided they wanted to temporarily up the employer contribution rate for 15-16, I would suggest not tampering with anything, but just taking money out of the valuation reserves and sticking it into the non-valuation reserves, into the contingency reserve, like a rainy day type deal. That way you wouldn't mess with the actuarial methods that have been put in place for the long run. I'm just saying if, and I'm not recommending it, suggesting it, or anything.
But if I understand this correctly, another big if, you're talking about reducing the contribution rate this year, but increasing it again maybe next year or the year after.
We're not reducing it this year.
Huh?
We're not reducing it this year.
It is still going up this year.
Pardon me?
It is still going up this year.
So if I get right, basically, the contribution rate's going up a bit. AM schedule's going down.
It is, correct.
Yeah.
Oh.
Which both help us.
Okay.
Because they're contributing more and we're taking the unfunded liability and shortening up the window they have to make that up.
Last year you didn't ask for last year you didn't ask for the full actuarial cost because you were phasing in those changes, so you reduced the contribution rate by about 1% of pay, less than what it would have been. This year you're not doing that, or the policy is that you're not doing that. So that's why the contribution rate is actually going up a little bit from last year to this year.
Because we didn't do it last year.
Right.
I just don't think we should make the whole people, and I know we have all these different ways to reformulate the basic number, but problem is the whole, and let's not make it deeper. That's all I'm saying.
Now, whether the whole is getting larger or not in dollar terms, some of that is, I said you're negatively amortizing, but we also have to remember the unfunded liability that we had been using is based on the smooth value of assets, and you also have some deferred gains. So even if you earn 7.75%, it's not necessarily the case that the smooth unfunded liability would go up in dollar terms next year anyway, because you do have these deferred investment gains.
Right. Remember, again, we have about $130 million set aside that Graham's not even incorporating into the actuarial valuation. So we do have a form of savings going on right now.
So what was your original question, Rick? You said that we had a couple of options. One is to take the report and have Graham.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. So we either need to send Graham back home and have him finalize the valuation based on what he's brought us preliminarily, or if you want to do some sort of change, like what's been bantered about here, which I don't think is going to happen, but if it does, then we send Graham back and give him some new information to come up with a different employer rate for 15-16.
I need marching orders.
I move that we proceed as proposed, and we don't need any additional information.
I second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any more discussion?
Well, we can still consider, like, the savings account option later, right, Rick?
Yes, anytime you want. We have a contingency reserve that essentially works at your pleasure. If you want to put money in, take it from the valuation reserves and stick it in there, you can. If you want to take money out when times are bad and stick it back into the valuation, you can as well. And plus, we have the other form of smoothing, which is part of the natural actuarial process.
The layering?
Just the
Smoothing.
Your basic smoothing.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you to get rid of that next year, but that's next year.
Oh, spoiler alert.
Okay, so we're ready for the question. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, so moved.
Thank you.
It is what it is.
I don't have anything for person.
Okay, so nothing, huh? Any news is good news? All righty, so we have members forum.
I've actually been using
Organization.
Nothing for me.
Nothing for me.
So we were just given this handout this afternoon, and I read page 7 of this little educational handout. There's a great, it appears to be a great program coming at Pepperdine at the end of August for trustees on all kinds of things, but mainly the principles of pension management. It's a 3-day educational course, and it looks decent, so I would like to go to this. I don't know if anybody else would.
Is that something we have to have the education
yes.
committee?
Are those already included?
It's CalPERS.
Okay. So CalPERS events.
Hey, it looks like a good little
session. It does look good. I did the SACRS one last year, which was quite dimensional.
That's a good time for me.
Oops. Sorry.
I have nothing
Jim,
today.
No. Mike?
Just to mention that we did, RESCO Insurance Committee did meet with Don and Jamie. And I think that we all came away with the concept that our issues are resolvable, and many of them have been resolved. And we've already started to work on next year's open enrollment, identified some things that would make it smoother and easier. I don't know if that's the feedback you got or not.
And would you care to comment on that, Don?
I completely agree with you. I think that we're already looking at next year, and we've got some great ideas going forward, and I think we're just going to keep making it better.
Yeah. And we appreciate the fact that staff really understood and understands how important the insurance is for our retirees, and secondarily that some of our retirees, and I'm getting there pretty quick, have conservators or are not really have some cognitive issues that make them difficult to manage to get enrolled in that kind of stuff, and we have, you know, dead addresses and different things, but we got many of them, or most of them worked out, and we hope that next year, I'm thinking, it just occurred to me that we ought to identify those folks so that next year we can
get an earlier jump on trying to get things straightened out for them
into the system.
I think as long as we keep the lines of communication open, we'll be fine.
Yeah. We appreciate it. Thank you.
So do we.
None.
Miguel?
No.
Miguel?
He responded, so.
I'm called that. I go by many names.
Nothing.
Right? Nothing? Okay, meeting adjourned.